Good evening, folks, and welcome back on this Saturday, August 24th. I'm your host, Mark Gall, and this week I'm going to do something a bit different than I've done most of the time of late. We're still going to talk about what's going on in the world, of course, and perhaps more importantly, what we can do about it, what we should do about it, but it's going to begin with a little bit different emphasis this week, because really there's a theme that's been resonating with me for quite a while now, and that's, who do you trust? All right, well, given the nature of the show, perhaps that's obvious. I've never hidden the fact that your host comes to radio with a biblical worldview, in particular, one that's based on the entire scripture, from Bereshit or Genesis to maps. As written, of course, because he says he doesn't change. And the bottom line of the whole book, of course, is to trust in him. In Yod Heh Vav Heh, in Yahuwah alone do we put our trust, and in no other fake master, false god, or fill in the blank. And it's on that point that I know this show will be different. In other words, even if you think you may have heard it, you haven't. Certainly we're warned in these times, be not deceived, lawlessness will abound. All of those things are more than obvious and increasing. At this point, much of the world has been deceived, and by definition, that means they don't know it, into worshiping another god, another master, false gods, American idols, and the like. Things the Bible forbids over and over and over again, and generally lumps into the category of paganism. And that's certainly all stuff that we've talked about before. So where I want to go this week is at the same time far more subtle, and that means a lot of folks are going to have trouble wrapping their heads around it and thinking, oh, he can't be serious now, can he? But yeah. And also far, far more imminently deadly. And thus the change in the emphasis, well, at least to start out. From who do you trust, because we know the answer there, if we understand Scripture, should be obvious, to who, for crying out loud, can we not trust? And the evidence is voluminous on that score, too. So let me start out with a look back at a historical event of which I was reminded earlier this week. Wednesday, August 21st, was the anniversary of one of the most pivotal events in the history of post-constitutional America. On August the 21st of 1992, 27 years ago this week, there was a shootout initiated by federal agents at Ruby Ridge, Idaho, that's credited with kicking off the constitutional militia movement, and without question, certainly kicking off a decline in the respect that those Americans who are paying attention have for so-called federal law enforcement. In no small part because those who ended up with notches on their gun at Ruby Ridge and Randy Weaver's family cabin, and quite a few of those who supervised the setup and subsequent cover-up, ended up at other places where we saw even more egregious violations, like first Waco and then Oklahoma City. And the well-planned anti-constitutional totalitarian reaction paved the way for other things that we're still seeing play out. Let me introduce some of what I'm going to talk about today by noting that several years after all of this happened, once I began my second career, if you will, as a radio talk show host, I had the opportunity to interview and then later meet Randy Weaver on several occasions. I also got to know Colonel Bo Greitz, who was intimately involved in this situation and others later as well. And of course, I'm very familiar with several books on the subject, including Randy Weaver's own, The Federal Siege at Ruby Ridge, written with his daughter Sarah, in our own words. So what I want to do today is at least recap some of the major events, especially for those who aren't familiar with this particularly pivotal moment in history, both from my own recollections and a pretty good piece that I saw to remind me of the anniversary on ammo.com entitled Siege at Ruby Ridge, the Forgotten History of the ATF Shootout that Started a Militia Movement, even though I couldn't find the author's name to give him or her credit. Their short version summary of the event goes like this. Randy Weaver and his wife Vicki moved with their four kids to the Idaho Panhandle near the Canadian border to escape what they thought was an increasingly corrupt world. And of course, they were a bit ahead of the curve. The Weavers did hold racial separatist beliefs, but were not involved in any violent activity or rhetoric at all. They were peaceful Christians with a bit more of an Old Testament understanding to boot, who simply wanted to be left alone. Specifically for his beliefs, Randy Weaver, though, was targeted by the unconstitutional, I put that in there, Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, a.k.a. ATF, and entrapped in a sting operation designed to coerce his cooperation as a snitch. And when he refused multiple times to become a federal informant, he was charged, and it was a bogus charge at that, with illegally selling firearms, in particular sawed-off shotguns. And due to what this story calls a miscommunication, and that's probably being overly charitable, Randy, as I recall, says they simply lied to him about his court date, the Marshal Service was brought in, who laid siege to his house, first killing the family dog, and then his 14-year-old son, Sammy, and then later his wife, Vicky, who was armed with nothing but their infant child. The background goes like this. Randy Weaver was, in many ways, a typical American story. He grew up in an Iowa farming community, got decent grades in high school, played football. His family attended church regularly. He then joined the United States Army in 1970 and was honorably discharged after 3 years of service. A month later, he married Victoria Jordison, and she became Vicky Weaver. He then enrolled in the University of Northern Iowa, studying criminal justice with an eye towards becoming an FBI agent. But he dropped out because the tuition was too expensive and ended up working in a John Deere plant while his wife worked first as a secretary and then a homemaker. Both of the Weavers, though, became increasingly apocalyptic in their view of the world. And that, says this piece, combined with their increasing emphasis on Old Testament-based Christianity, led them to seek a life away from mainstream America, a life of self-reliance. And to that end, Randy purchased a 20-acre farm in Ruby Ridge, Idaho, and built a cabin there, while Vicky homeschooled their children. After the move to Idaho, the Weavers became acquainted with various members of the Aryan Nations in nearby Hayden Lake, and Weaver even attended some rallies. The FBI, though, believed his involvement in the church was much deeper than it actually was. They thought he was a regular congregant, while in fact the Weavers may have agreed with a few tenets of the Aryan Nations, primarily about the importance of the Old Testament, but in other areas had what he described as major theological differences. Still, though, living off-grid in a remote area, nearby members of the Aryan Nations were in fact their neighbors. Both Randy and Vicky were interviewed by the FBI in 1985, and in 86, Randy was approached at a rally by an undercover ATF informant named Kenneth Faderly, who instead used a biker alter ego name of Gus Magasono and was currently monitoring and investigating one of Weaver's friends, Frank Kumnick. And this is where the plot thickens. The ATF claims that in 1989, Faderly managed to purchase two illegally shortened shotguns. In fact, they were a fraction of an inch shorter than the so-called legal limit from Randy Weaver. Weaver, though, claims that the shotguns as he sold them were entirely legal and were shortened after the fact. And the case notes show that Faderly purchased the guns and even showed Weaver exactly where to shorten them, which would constitute illegal entrapment. And what's more, the government preyed on the destitute nature of the Weavers, who lived in a small cabin in the woods without electricity or running water, thinking they might be just desperate enough to fall for it. The real purpose of the investigation, though, wasn't ever to grab Weaver, but it was to use him to infiltrate a group in Montana being organized by one Charles Howarth, which didn't work. In November of 1989, Weaver refused to introduce Faderly to Howarth, and Faderly was then ordered by his handlers to have no further contact with Weaver. Then in June of 1990, Faderly's cover was blown, whereupon the FBI, and I like this term, reached out to Randy Weaver, stating they had evidence he was dealing illegal firearms, and he'd either turn snitch or else. Yeah, though, they would drop all charges if he would just agree to become their new informant regarding the investigation of Aryan Nations groups in the area. And again, Weaver refused. So they upped the ante on the coercion again. The Fed staged a stunt where a broken-down couple were at the side of the road, and the kind-hearted Weaver stopped to help them and was then handcuffed, thrown face down in the snow, and arrested. He ended up having to post his home as a bond, and still he refused to become a federal informant. Now here's where the irony really drips off the story. You kind of wonder, why did they really need an additional informant within the Aryan Nations? Because it turns out that different branches of federal law enforcement, SIC, and intelligence gathering already had not one, not two, but five of the six key positions in the entire organization, meaning that the Aryan Nations were effectively a government-run racist shop to begin with agents spying on each other in order to ensure the integrity of the so-called investigation, one that they pretty much ran from the ground up. Now here I pause and ask another question over a quarter of a century later. How long have we been hearing about so-called white supremacists? Now they got a new term too, white nationalist, which they lump in and demonize with the same overarching term. And isn't it funny that all kinds of people who really aren't that are now being called that? From a president that they didn't want elected in the first place, on down to far too many of his supporters, including a bunch, evidently, who don't even turn out to be white. But it turns out, maybe it's been going on a long time and isn't really that new. Oh, and if you're wondering why they don't pay nearly so much attention to real terrorist organizations, up to and including real fascists that call themselves Antifa, not to mention ISIS and other racist criminal drug lord gangs like MS-13, you're not alone. But I guess, come to think of it, maybe they really are running those organizations with 5 out of 6 or so of the key positions in each of them as well. Who knows? Trouble is, we can't trust them to tell us the truth anyway, and stories like this one help us to see just how deep and how far back that nasty evil rabbit hole really goes. And by the way, folks, there are lots and lots of spin-off tales to this one, all the way up and down the line as well. But due to his ongoing refusal to switch, Weaver was arrested in January of 1991 on, say it with me, illegal firearms sale charges. And if we actually had a constitution, there's no such thing. But the charges stem from Weaver's earlier so-called sale of 2 shortened shotguns to Faderly, the undercover ATF agent, a sale which the feds themselves later admitted constituted illegal entrapment, but hey, they're the feds, so they can get away with things like that. And Weaver's court date was originally set for February 19th of 1991, then changed the next day. And they lied to Weaver and told him that his court date wasn't until March 20th, so he missed the February court appearance and had a bench warrant issued for his arrest. And that in itself is a long and disgusting story. But suffice it for now to say that, already skeptical of the feds after their repeated strong-arm tactics, and now their further evidence that Randy wasn't going to receive a fair trial, or maybe even a trial at all anyway, they increasingly isolated themselves up on their Ruby Ridge farm, vowing to fight rather than to surrender peacefully. During this interval, though, a voluntary surrender date was negotiated via the Marshal Service for October of 1991, but the United States Attorney's Office refused that settlement, and then-Deputy Director of the Special Operations Group of the Marshal Service, using evidence obtained through surveillance, believed the best course of action was to actually drop the indictment, issue a new one under seal, use undercover agents to arrest Weaver, who presumably might have, sometime along the line, dropped his guard, and that too was rejected. So on August the 21st of 1992, 6 heavily armed, camouflaged U.S. Marshals went to the Weaver property, allegedly for reconnaissance. But the Weaver's dogs gave away the position of the Marshals, alerting their 14-year-old son Sammy and a 24-year-old friend of the family named Kevin Harris, who investigated why the dogs were barking and what they were barking at. Here's where the accounts vary, but quite frankly, folks, I believe the Weaver's story. Lots and lots of reasons, but just how many times have we seen police shoot dogs first or worry about anything else later since then? The Marshals refused to identify themselves and shot and killed Sammy's dog, Striker. Whereupon Sammy responded with something to the effect of, "You blankety blank, you killed my dog," and shot back. Whereupon Sammy was shot in the back by federal agents after he yelled, "I'm coming, Dad," trying to run back to the house. And as you've probably seen many times since then, the situation only escalates from this point. The FBI's infamous hostage rescue team, or after Waco, some have referred to them as the hostage roasting team because they like to burn down buildings, was called in to assess the situation. They brought sniper teams. One of them tried for a kill shot on Randy while he was at the shed viewing the body of his dead son. But instead, since he moved at the last second, the shot entered his shoulder and exited to his armpit. They were much more effective later when the infamous murderer Lon Horiuchi, FBI sniper, who later showed up and did similar work, sick, from the backside of the burning church in Waco, Texas, managed to catch sight of Vicki Weaver holding her 10-month-old daughter Elisheba in her arms and shoot her right through the neck. And by the way, this same Lon Horiuchi reportedly bragged about being able to hit a target smaller than a quarter from a far greater distance than his execution of Vicki Weaver. And interestingly, the same shot that killed Vicky also hit Kevin Harris, and some of us tend to suspect you can almost imagine Horiuchi bragging about that shot later. And if you have any doubts on that score, understand this. In the following 10-day standoff, between 350 and 400 agents who cruelly named their camp camp. Vicky would routinely call out to the people ensconced inside, "Vicky, we have blueberry pancakes," and then later claimed, "Oh, they didn't know she was already dead." What a bunch of scumbags. And get this. A so-called internal investigation later found that the second shot, the one that killed Vicky Weaver, was out of policy, and their failure to request a surrender was, quote, inexcusable. Because Lon Horiuchi, the FBI executioner, fired through a door without seeing who was on the other side of it, yeah, sure, at people who were fleeing and posed no threat. He was later actually charged with manslaughter in these deaths, but the charges were dropped. Why? Well, because of a guy named William Barr, among other things. Now the Attorney General, who argued for immunity of FBI snipers for any murders which they should commit on the inhabitants of these states. And that kind of sounds familiar, doesn't it? And although, of course, nobody who's talking knows for sure, it looks like Lon Horiuchi ended up in the Witness Protection Program. He's probably on a beach sipping Mai Tais somewhere, still sucking off the taxpayers' teat. But the siege eventually ended for a number of reasons. Supporters of the Weavers and opponents of the ATF and FBI formed a vigil outside the area. Weaver's commanding officer from Vietnam, Colonel James Beau Greitz, who was at the time running for president on the Populist Party ticket, acted as a mediator between the family and various government agents. Radio broadcaster Paul Harvey, good day, remember him, intervened as well, offering to pay for Weaver's robust defense if he would surrender. And that, among other things, led Weaver to abandon the standoff and finally surrender to federal authorities. He was charged with 10 counts, including the original charges, of course, of so-called illegal firearm sales. But his attorney, the legendary Jerry Spence, successfully defended Weaver against that host of charges, including murder, via an argument of self-defense. And ultimately, a jury found him not guilty on all of those counts, except the original failure to appear, for which he was sentenced to 18 months in prison and a fine of $10,000, then credited with time served, plus 3 months. Kevin Harris, too, was acquitted of all charges, and these, it says, were the longest deliberations in Idaho criminal history. Then Weaver sued the federal government, which managed to avoid a civil trial by settling for $3.1 million, $1 million to each of the 3 surviving Weaver children, and $100,000 to Randy, although, of course, they never admitted any wrongdoing. And after several years of appeal, Kevin Harris eventually received a settlement of $380,000 himself. And in all of this, says the ammo story, it's worth noting that the FedGov took active steps, and this doesn't sound familiar now, does it, to cover their tracks. After the failed siege at Ruby Ridge, the chief of the Bureau's so-called Violent Crimes and Major Offenders section, and how's that for an ironic but apt name, pled guilty to attempting to destroy all copies of the FBI's internal report on their siege, while federal judge Edward Lodge penned a lengthy list of misdeeds, including fabrication of evidence and refusing to comply with court orders. And as investigative reporter James Bovard later summarized it, Lodge slammed the Just Us Department and the FBI for concealing evidence and showing what he called a, quote, callous disregard for the rights of the defendants and the interests of justice, whereupon the Just Us Department conducted their internal investigation and compiled a 542-page report detailing federal misconduct and cover-ups in the case and even suggesting criminal charges against FBI officials involved in Ruby Ridge. What anybody in the public was allowed to see was, of course, highly redacted. The 6 marshals involved in the original shootout were given the highest commendations by the United States Marshal Service. Some of the high-profile FBI players went on to play even greater roles in the Waco, Texas church massacre. But there were at least a few traditional wrist slaps. In 1997, the Just Us Department declined to prosecute senior FBI officials for covering up the details of the wannabe massacre on Ruby Ridge. 2 FBI agents were prosecuted. One served 18 months in prison for destruction of evidence, and the other had charges dismissed. While the second in command of the FBI was demoted, 3 other agents were suspended. And honestly, folks, as I read that part of the story, I got to thinking, no, there was really far more to it. And I went back and looked up a piece from James Bovard on last year's anniversary, entitled Ruby Ridge and the Federal Agent's License to Kill, where he quotes some of his own still earlier stories and noted how then FBI Director Louis Free, I guess in the finest tradition of cover-ups that that agency is now famous for, defended the execution of Vicky Weaver with a whole bunch of whoppers. including threats to non-existent helicopters, but then did somehow manage to find 12 FBI officials guilty of, quote, inadequate performance, improper conduct, neglect of duty, and failure to exert proper managerial oversight. However, for all of that, the heaviest penalty that Free himself imposed was 15 whole days of unpaid leave, and that for only 4 agents. And as Bovard notes, and the New York Times even reported, Free has imposed heavier penalties on FBI agents who use their official cars to drive their children to school. But wait, there's more, and this kind of also fits a continuing pattern. Says Bovard, one of the most disturbing aspects of Free's actions has been his treatment of Larry Potts, Free's pick as acting deputy FBI director. Kind of like the Andy McCabe of the day. Potts was the senior official in charge of the Ruby Ridge operation and defended the shoot-to-kill orders there. And despite the findings of that Just Us Department confidential report that the orders had actually violated constitutional rights, Free recommended Potts face only the penalty of a letter of censure, the same penalty that Free himself received when he lost an FBI cell phone. And as we now know, Potts went on later to become one of the co-stars of the FBI Branch Davidian Church Massacre in Waco. All of which leads me to the final paragraph in this piece from Ammo.com. They say, this being Ruby Ridge, followed shortly thereafter by Waco, then Oklahoma City, then still later others from 9/11 to false flags like Las Vegas and who knows how many others, and subsequent gross abuses of the God-given rights once protected by the Constitution and federal cover-ups thereof. They tried to get away with something similar to Bundy Ranch, too, but didn't, thanks in no small part to patriots who showed up bearing arms and a jury who saw through the FBI's lies there, too. This is why those in the freedom, patriot, constitutional, survival, and Second Amendment movements remember this day, because it's a chilling reminder of the predatory and aggressive nature of federal so-called law enforcement. That, of course, and a now finally being uncovered coup attempt against a duly elected president. From there, if I tried to just even outline the various infringements and proofs that corrupt criminal organizations, yep, I said it, like the Federal Bureau of Instigation, as opposed to investigation, have been undermining the Republic for decades and committing incredible, and of course, like we saw at Ruby Ridge, then later some of the very same players at the mass murders of that Seventh-day Adventist church in Waco, unprosecuted murders followed by obstruction of justice, well, we'd run out of time. We've already talked about Lon Horiuchi, who not only got away with murder at Ruby Ridge, but then upped the ante, big time, at Waco. The same goes for much of the corrupt management, who not only did it there, but then 2 years to the day later repeated the feat at the Oklahoma City false flag, where again the collateral damage included a whole lot of dead children, and a lot of really damning evidence, this time against the Clinton crime family, was oh so coincidentally destroyed. And as I pointed out at length in literally hours of shows over the years, it doesn't even take a basic high school physics level of understanding to realize in so many ways that the entire Murrah Building lone bomber narrative sold to us by a gullible media and a willfully blind bunch of idiots in Congress was one of the most utterly unbelievable scenarios and pitifully inept cover-ups to boot ever foisted on a dumbed-down American public. And yes, folks, I'm pulling my punches on that. But those false flags did succeed in bringing formerly free Americans, first the Anti-Terror Act, which was the precise opposite, and then later, as it turns out, just a few days after one Robert Mueller became head whoremeister at the feral bunglers of investigations, 9/11, followed bang, bang thereafter by the biblically misnamed Patriot Act. Since then, we've had false flag after false flag, gun-free killing zone massacre involving unreported SSRIs after gun-free killing zone mass murder and massacre. In every single case, without exception, you'll notice that the one common thread, well, besides SSRIs and gun-free killing zones, is that you never see the videos. Because somebody, and I bet you can guess the three-letter initials, manages to swoop in and make sure that, just like Oklahoma City, Americans are never allowed to see actual evidence. So if we're finally seeing a lack of trust for certain tyrannical police state entities, you'd have to say it's been well-earned. We'll be right back. We're killing our babies before they-
nothing but the devil's pound. Whose side are you on? Whose side are you on?
Welcome back now to the second segment of the show for this evening. This is your host, Mark Hall, and we're talking about not only where we should put our trust, but given the evidence, where we certainly shouldn't. And part of the reason I realized I needed to do this show was that I guess you could say I had it pointed out to me, perhaps surprisingly, that it's far more difficult to get people who have been properly conditioned by Big Brother not to trust in police state organizations that are ever so eminently untrustworthy than it is to get them to trust in a God that has proven his faithfulness for multiple millennia. And here's the real irony. The same people will claim to believe in him, but they don't trust him. They will claim they recognize that organizations like the IRS, ATF, FBI, NSA, CIA, and ETC have been lying to them over and over and over and over again. And yeah, of course they know it, and yeah, of course they don't really trust them. But when push comes to shove, they trust them more than they do the God of their salvation. They'll even watch them put their hands on a Bible and lie, and still don't seem to get it. And that leads me to where I'm headed next. Is President Donald J. Trump a less evil entity than Her Highness Hitler would have ever been? No doubt about it. But could a Barry Sotero or Hillary Clinton have implemented the kinds of Soviet-style red flag gun confiscation orders that President Trump is now pushing and gotten away with it? Or would we have had a civil war by now? No doubt about it. Can we not see when trust, even if it looks like a lesser evil alternative, is utterly unwarranted, especially based on fruit? So, two quick stories to bring that point home. And I'll say up front two things. First, and hopefully obviously, take them with a grain of salt. And two, if we still had a constitution or elected representatives who could read it, and sadly, of late that seems to include the president too, we wouldn't be having stories like this anyway. First, from Breitbart, President Donald Trump suggested that Democrats have given up any defense of the Second Amendment. But he pledged that he will not allow Americans' gun rights to be swept away on what he called the slippery slope of gun control. And if that's even remotely true, well, it's past time. Trump made the comments, it says, while speaking to reporters in the Oval Office on Tuesday, saying, quote, "We have very, very strong background checks right now." And full stop, folks. If we still had a Second Amendment and it wasn't infringed, we wouldn't have prior restraint on formerly free people's right to purchase or own or keep and bear anything, but especially not property protected by the Second Amendment. So the president basically is already saying the Second Amendment is being infringed. Can you feel a whole lot of slipping going on? Because he said, we have very, very strong background checks right now, but we have sort of missing areas, and areas that don't complete the whole circle, and we're looking at different things, unquote. So, our unconstitutional background checks aren't yet complete enough? He added, quote, and I have to tell you that it is a mental problem. I'll just let that sit there and stink for a second. And I've said it 100 times, it's not the gun that pulls the trigger, it's the person that pulls the trigger. These are sick people, and it is also that kind of a problem, unquote. Well, folks, if these people are that deadly dangerous, then what are they doing on the streets to begin with? Aren't there a lot of ways to kill people? If we're really concerned about stopping various kinds of attacks, why don't we just lock them all up? Oh yeah, that should sit and stink too, shouldn't it? But wait a minute, wouldn't that violate due process? Well, yeah, but so do red flag confiscation orders and just about everything else that they're talking about. So why do we even pretend we still have a constitution, much less a bill of rights? Trump was then asked point blank if he wanted to see Senate passage of gun control bills passed in the Communist House. And he responded, "Well, I'm not going to get into that. But we are in very meaningful discussions with the Democrats, and I think the Republicans are very unified. We are very strong on our Second Amendment. The Democrats are not strong at all on the Second Amendment." Okay, stop. That's enough of that. Not a one of them, folks, has actually bothered to point out that "shall not be infringed" isn't a request. He did say we have to be careful about giving up on the Second Amendment because, you know, they call it the slippery slope, and all of a sudden, everything gets taken away. We're not going to let that happen. Unquote, and show me, Mr. President. Because quite frankly, those of us who have been watching the fruit here don't believe a word of it. Oh, speaking of which, there's this from Wayne LaPierre, CEO and executive sellout, and I know firsthand, of the National Registration Association, who tweeted that he'd spoken with the president. He's a strong Second Amendment kind of guy, oh, just like Wayne is. And he assures him that universal background checks are off the table. But you might note they didn't say anything about the most unconstitutional abomination since the Alien and Sedition Acts, Soviet-style red flag gun confiscation. And here, folks, is where all this absolutely, yeah, I'm going to say it, offensive, not just insane and obviously unconstitutional, ought to really rub Americans that have been paying attention to what's been going on for decades the wrong way. The anti-constitutional ATF tries to entrap Randy Weaver into violating a law that really isn't a law at all and sawing off a shotgun that Americans have every right to keep and bear just a fraction of an inch too short. And when he won't cave in, they send in first the marshals, then the FBI's HRT to literally execute the whole fam-damily. Oh, and let's demonize him and call him a white supremacist, too. Hey, that's still working. They're trying it with the president now. And they followed that up with some of the very same people by executing about 7 dozen people in total in a church in Waco. Based on what? Oh yeah, an alleged violation that turns out to have been another whopper of that same anti-constitutional 1934 infringement of the Second Amendment called the National Firearms Act. You may recall the ATF called that one, originally, Operation Showtime. Got some people killed up front. And in the end, they spent millions of dollars and killed dozens of people over $400 of federal firearms taxes. But no doubt about it, it did show Americans who was boss and who couldn't be trusted. Even if it took years for the most damning evidence to come out, and the waste stream and the Congress still won't acknowledge it. And, of course, more recently, in a whole bunch of false flags and gun control failures later, they're still pushing the total and complete destruction of what's left of the Bill of Rights. And how's this for irony? The same president that couldn't trust the CIA, NSA, and FBI to wiretap his phones and complete the Russia lie coup against his administration isn't saying that those insane, lying you-know-whats should have their guns taken away, because if there ever was a need for a red flag law, it would be the Reds in the three-letter agencies. No, he's saying those people can be trusted to take your guns away on their say-so. And how absolutely insane is that? And if we're not cynical by now, folks, we're missing the entire point here. That's my point. So, next case in point. A piece from former federal judge, now Fox correspondent, Andrew Napolitano, who's been wrong a lot lately but seems to have nailed this one. In a piece entitled, "More Spying and Lying," he says, "While most of us have been thinking about the end of the summer and the political class frets over the so-called presidential candidates that the leftist communists have been putting forward, as well as the aborted visits of those two Jihad Squad members to Israel, the Trump administration has moved quietly to extend and make permanent not just the continued gang rape of the Second Amendment, but the government's authority to spy on anybody and everybody in America." So, never talk about where your guns are going to be buried on the phone, I guess. He suggests the president, who's never otherwise at a loss for words, must have been asked by the intelligence community that he once reviled not to address these matters in public. But those matters do include the very means and the very secret court about which he complained loud and long during the Mueller witch hunt. Now, though, he wants to be able to permanently unleash on all the rest of us the very evils he claims were visited upon him by the Obama regime and the infamous Federal Bureau of Instigation. So what's going on, says the judge. Here's the backstory. After the Watergate-era lawlessness was exposed, a president spying on his political adversaries, although a lot less brazenly than we've seen since, and without warrants, of course, Congress enacted in 1978 the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, which prescribed a means for surveillance other than that required by the Constitution. You know, that Fourth Amendment thing. Written in the aftermath of British soldiers and agents using general warrants obtained from a secret court in London to spy on whomever in the colonies they felt like and seize whatever they wanted. It was put in the Bill of Rights to prohibit the very things the Brits were doing then and the D.C. swamp is doing now. Thus, he said, we have the constitutional requirement for searches and seizures needing a warrant, issued by a judge based on a showing under oath of probable cause of crime. And FISA, instead, is an unconstitutional congressional effort to lower the standards once required by that Bill of Rights. Can Congress do that, he asks? Of course not. Because if they could, we wouldn't have a constitution. And right there is a proof of something worth thinking about. But still, it gets worse. The court established by FISA, the same court that President Donald Trump asserts authorized spying on him back in 2015 and 2016, has morphed the requirement of probable cause of being a foreign agent to probable cause of just communicating to a foreign person as the standard for authorizing surveillance. Basically, it's now a means of spying on just about anybody, anytime. And you add to this the 2002 secret order of President George W. Bush directing the no such agency to spy on all America all the time, and we don't need no stinking warrant, which is what Ed Snowden exposed in 2013, and we can see where all of it's led. The creation of a surveillance state in America that came about by secret court rulings and once secret presidential orders. FISA bypasses the entire concept of warrants altogether, spies on everyone in America, denies it, and lies about it. Napolitano notes that Bill Binney, the genius mathematician who once worked for the NSA and is now its harshest critic, oh, and they did try to kill him, folks, has stated many times that as unconstitutional as FISA is, it's a pretext to NSA spying on all persons in America all the time. Which takes us back to that oh-so-quiet late-summer proposal by the Trump regime. Some of the statutes that govern who can go to the FISA court and under what circumstances they can go. Remember, folks, what we've seen from the FBI indicates they can lie to the FISA court with impunity. Are, horror of horrors, about to expire. Now, Judge Napolitano says inexplicably the very president, once victimized by FISA, now wants to make these statutes permanent, and he wants to do so knowing that they're essentially a facade for unconstitutional, illegal, and, yeah, politically motivated, even spying. And the result would be to institutionalize the now decades-long federal assault on privacy and evasion of constitutional protections. And at this point, folks, your host has to interject a comment as well. What would be the point of making unconstitutional provisions temporary? Almost like Congress knew that what they were doing was an utter violation of the Bill of Rights, and so they said, oh, let's just do it for a little while. And I guess that way, if they don't work out, they can expire without necessarily creating a permanent police state. And so what happens once it's proven just how egregiously they have in fact been abused and resulted in exactly the same kind of police state horrors that those who knew better knew they would and the founders were trying to guard against? Think about it. Yeah. Well, they failed, so let's make them permanent. What kind of logic is that other than congressional? Oh, and traitorous. Concludes Napolitano. As long as we still have a constitution, it must be taken seriously and must mean what it says. Well, folks, I think the conclusion is obvious. Since it clearly doesn't, we don't. So let me ask it again. Why would you trust these people who put their hands on a Bible and lie to take away your constitutionally protected rights, your guns, and yeah, in the process, to play God? Can there be any doubt again where it would be downright stupid to place your trust? Which reminds me of a couple of things, folks. First, a quote from one of my favorite human authors, Robert Heinlein, who once said, "If a man speaks of his honor, make him pay cash." The Bible, of course, reminds us that cash, or real money, is in fact silver. And interestingly, back when we had a constitution, it agreed, saying, "Nothing but gold or silver coin shall be made a tender in payment of debts." And it didn't allow for a Federal Reserve either, of course. Which reminds me of another old saying when it comes to crooks and criminality and lawlessness, "Follow the money." And that in turn leads me to some salient related comments from Brandon Smith, freedom and liberty-oriented author with an economic bent, about the real reasons that both he and I have talked about before as to why the media is suddenly admitting that there really could be a recession coming soon to a theater near you. As every good Austrian economist has noted for quite some time now, the end of the biggest debt bubble in history is inevitable. The trouble is, President Trump's now been in office for long enough that he'll almost certainly take the fall for it, and it doesn't help that he's ponied up for the great big stock market bubble, and now claims credit for overvaluations he once criticized, which will implode right along with everything else. Brandon Smith has long warned that a president that tries to take credit for a stock market bubble will take the blame for when it pops, and he's gone a step further and suggested that the Fed and the various globalist banksters have been setting the guy up and seeing if he'd step in it. And now that he has, the next steps are getting clearer. In his piece this week, Brandon Smith says one thing that's important to understand about the waste stream media is that they do occasionally tell the truth. However, the truths they admit are almost always wrapped in lies or told to the public far too late to make the admission of any use. Like, for example, dumbed-down fluoride-addled kids, I can't help but think. Or maybe the deadly dangers of 5G a few years down the line. Dissecting mainstream media information and sifting out the truth from propaganda is really the bulk of what the alternative media either does or should be doing. And in the past couple of weeks, he writes, I've received a rash of emails asking about the sudden flood of recession and economic crash talk in the waste stream. Does this abrupt 180-degree turn by the MSM and globalist banks on the economy warrant concern? Answer, of course it does. And, of course, he continues, there will be a number of people who will assume mainstream reports of imminent economic crisis are merely an attempt to tarnish the image of the Trump administration and that any talk of recession is thus overblown, which is partially true. Trump may be meant to act as the scapegoat, but that's not the real, total big picture. The fact is, the pattern the media is following today, he writes, totally matches almost exactly the pattern they followed right up to the credit crash of 2008. Make no mistake, he says, and your host can't help but agree, a financial crash is indeed happening right now, just as it did after media warnings back in 2007 and 8, and the reasons why the MSM is admitting to it today are calculated. And to understand how all of this works, it's helpful to take a look back to the way the media reacted leading up to the 2008 crash. They ignored all the signals as far back as 2005 and 6, despite ample warnings from alternative and, of course, Austrian economists. In fact, they mostly laughed at the prospect of the biggest bull market in the history of stocks and housing, at least at that time, actually collapsing. And then abruptly, the media and the globalist institutions that dictate how the news is disseminated began to shift position. They started talking about recession and the potential for a crash. From the New York Times to the Telegraph to Reuters and others, as well as the IMF, BIS, and of course Fed, everyone all of a sudden started agreeing with alternative economists without actually deferring to them or giving them any credit for making the correct calls. And instead, during 2007 and 8, the discussion revolved around derivatives, a subject just complicated enough to confuse most people and cause them to be disinterested in the root trigger for the coming crisis, while the central banksters created and deflated bubbles through policy engineering. Indeed, all the public wanted to know was how the crash was going to be fixed. And remember, nobody was actually punished. Yes, it was, of course, the perfect storm of coincidences. And the central banksters were applauded for their swift action in coming in and bailing themselves right back out, giving us QE to infinity to save us all from a depression-level event, and the banksters were referred to, instead of villains, as heroes. Later, of course, even Alan Greenspan, the maestro, admitted there was a bubble, but you can never tell these things until it's too late. Today, he says, we have a very similar dynamic. Use of the R word in the waystream media and amongst the central banksters has been strictly contained for a number of years. Back in October 2012, in the Fed minutes, Jerome Powell, now chairman, specifically warned about what would happen if the Federal Reserve tightened liquidity and raised interest rates into economic weakness, warning that this would have negative effects on the stimulus-addicted investment environment that the central bank itself had fostered. That discussion was held back from the public, but as soon as Powell became chairman, he implemented exactly what he said would cause a problem. And shazam, it has. And it's only over the last couple of weeks that outlets have become aggressive in pushing the notion that a financial crash is finally just around the corner. So instead of warning about the dangers of what's been coming for 2 or 3 years, you have to ask, what's changed? Well, obviously, there's some speculation required as to the timing, but it's clear from their efforts to stifle free discussion that they don't want to let the populace know too far ahead of time that a crash is coming. And the excuse, of course, is, well, that would bring it on. Nevertheless, as he's pointed out, the fact that central banksters often engineer crash events in order to consolidate wealth and centralize their power is a provable conspiracy. And in general, when they finally do allow their puppet media outlets to report on the facts, it seems they do so about 6 to 8 months of warning time ahead of the economic shock to follow. Although in this case, the time frame may be shorter. And on that point, he engages in a brief digression regarding the no-deal Brexit scheduled for the end of October and how that too will be part of the blame game for what's inevitably going to happen anyway. As Germany and its Deutsche Bank, insolvent Italy, and the rest of the EU all prepare for their own Lehman moment. So in multiple ways, now, they have their scapegoat in the form of Donald Trump, with Brexit being his EU counterpart, and by extension, a scapegoat in the form of conservatives, populists, and sovereignty activists. So what we're seeing now, he concludes, is that the waystream media and the global bankster institutions have two goals in informing the public about recession now. One is, of course, CYA. When the next shoe drops, they can say at least they tried to warn us. It was just too late. And the second is to condition the majority of the public to automatically blame the very conservatives and sovereignty proponents who tried to warn them further ahead of time when the inevitable consequences hit them without mercy. We're looking at the crash of the everything bubble, and the wise by now have had more warning than the waste stream ever intended. As far as what all that means in the bigger picture, Brandon Smith concludes by suggesting that the pace of the narrative is quickening, and that means the collapse of the everything bubble might move rather quickly too, perhaps over the next 4 to 6 months. And if it does, it's likely Trump has not been slated for a second term as president in 2020, and given his highly divisive support for red flag laws, his complete abdication, in other words, of the Constitution that he took an oath to preserve and protect and defend, that'll probably cost him considerable support among those who formed the majority of his base at one point. Also, that indicates to me, says Smith, he might not be meant to be president in 2020. Another sign, too, that the massive downturn is closing in. As events are unfolding now, though, he says, it looks like Trump may have served his purpose for the globalists. And here I'll pause and interject briefly. Can you imagine if Barack Hussein Obama or a Hillary Clinton, which we all thought was the plan, had tried to put a federal red flag confiscation law in place? Why, they'd have had their hot Civil War 2.0 going strong by now. So, continues Smith, that means Trump has been slated to be replaced, undoubtedly with a far-left extreme communist of what would have once been called the Democrats. There are only a couple of scenarios in which I can imagine Trump remaining in office, he says, one of them being the usual major world war. But a leftist could do that just as easily as Trump, provided his elitist cabinet lays out the groundwork beforehand. By the way, folks, I can think of one other. The Fed actually caves in, pulls out the stops, QE to infinity, money printing like we've never seen before, and the resultant hyperinflation doesn't really kick in until after the election. Presuming, of course, that the Chinese or the Russians don't stick a final pin in the economic bubble and blow everything up before then. All of which leads to at least one pretty much undeniable conclusion. The major economic breakdown does seem to be slated real soon now, probably before the election of 2020, if not even sooner than that. Can you see things beginning to come to a head? I'm reminded that during the last Great Depression, America was mostly rural, family farms were the rule, and a far, far greater percentage of Americans were self-sufficient than even know what that word means anymore. This next one, for all the reasons we've talked about this hour and more, is going to be downright ugly. The Messiah in Matthew 24 warns us about the time, now it would seem, when lawlessness will abound and the love of many will grow cold. We already ought to know in whom we trust. But if we want to endure to the end and be saved, as that same verse continues, it's really, really important to know, for crying out loud, in whom we should not trust. They've earned that distrust because we've been deceived for far too long. And it's getting thicker by the day.